you know, I went from having about a 46% success rate in the Cascades to about an 85% success rate on the Coast Range, just simply because you start working with a system and eliminating all the fluff.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast, and thanks for tuning in. Our guests on this episode are Corey and Shannon from Angry Spike Productions. Corey and Shannon and the guys from Angry Spike have been hunting the Northwest and hunting big Roosevelt bulls for years. In this episode, we talk about the differences and commonalities between Roosevelt and Rocky Mountain elk, and then get into particular strategies and tactics that Corey and Shannon use to hunt those mature bulls in the Pacific Northwest. If you're into elk at all, whether it's Rosies or Rockies, you'll certainly pull something from this episode. We do talk about specific Roosevelt tactics at times, but even someone like myself, who has only hunted Rockies and will only do so for the foreseeable future, can pull a lot out of this episode, so I hope you guys enjoy it. We also talk a little bit about Angry Spike, and one thing Corey mentioned in the episode is setting you guys up with a discount code for any of their videos. I just want to let you know in this intro, he did do that. So you can just use the coupon code EXO, E-X-O, over at Angry Spike Productions for their on-demand content. And it knocks it down to like $3 for over 10 hours of their film. So it's a great deal. If you guys are interested, go check that out. Before we dive into the show, I also wanted to give a shout out to Blaine Reinowski for the iTunes review. Blaine, please contact us with your shipping information. We'll get some Hunt Backcountry Podcast and Exo Mountain Gear swag headed your way. Listeners, we want your feedback, so contact us directly via email to podcast@exomountaingear.com or leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you might be listening to this. All right, let's get into this show. We're in the midst of elk season as this episode is being released, and hopefully you can take some information from this show and then go put it into the field within a matter of days and weeks, and maybe it'll change the outcome of your hunt for you. Let's hear about it. Corey, Shannon, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Steve, how's it going today, bud?
I'm good. Sitting in the office, trying to pretend to work because all I can think about is hunting.
Yeah, I think we're all distracted at this point. I'm not sure exactly what the release date for this is, but I know that it's all getting close for all of us. Corey and Shannon, you guys are headed out tomorrow for getting into opening weekend, so everybody's a bit anxious for sure, but I'm glad we can make this happen before we all get too busy and too far into September. Just to start with, if you want to kick us off here, Shannon, just go ahead and give us some kind of introduction and background or who you are and what you've been up to kind of in the hunting world.
All right. Hey, I'm Shannon Mobbs. I started Angry Spike Productions. We basically film our Roosevelt elk hunts, or all of our hunting for that matter anymore. Our primary focus is the coastal Roosevelts here in Oregon and Washington, and just love sharing our experiences with everybody and interacting with the hunting communities.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And Corey, how did you get involved with Angry Spike and get connected with Shannon there?
Shannon and I kind of grew up together. I graduated high school with his younger brothers, and Shannon and I and both of his brothers used to all wrestle, youth wrestling growing up. So I've known Shannon for a long, long time, and it's about 6 or 7 years ago now. I was planning an Oregon hunt and just happened to, had kind of worked out that I was going to tag along with Shannon and the group that he was hunting with at the time, and got down there, and we had a pretty good successful first season. Bunch of guys killed bulls, and then, you know, you have a few guys that weren't willing to commit to spending the money on tags and other guys that are willing to commit to wanting to film, and You know, 6 or 7 years later, here we are. I try to film as much of Shannon's hunts as I can to try to make sure we get good quality video and obviously do some hunting on my own too. So,
you guys were filming before filming became, I think, what it is today, with a lot of people trying to make it in and do films, and whether that's for, you know, a film tour or for online or for a DVD. I mean, you guys have been doing it a long time. I'm curious, what was it that back then, years ago, you guys got started filming? How did that come together? What made you want to do that?
Right. So in the early 90s, probably around 93, 94, I got a camcorder, handheld camcorder for Christmas. And we had been calling bulls in prior to that, but nobody ever believed us. You know, growing up, we were always told that these Roosevelts don't bugle. You don't hunt them like that. But once we started trying it and, you know, started being successful at it and telling people the stories, you just get a bunch of head shakes and people, you know, ignoring what you're saying. So I started filming it, and then I made a VHS video.
And what is that?
that process was horrible, making a VHS tape.
I can imagine.
And also I made like 20 of them, and then people just, you know, sold every one of them to friends and family for the most part. But, you know, then people started realizing, hey, this is entertaining, this is good stuff. And after that is when we just started growing a little bit and got more better technology, and of course technology grew and changed, and editing became a lot simpler. And then it just kind of grew from there. And in the beginning, it was myself and Brad Croco, who is still a member of ASB. He's just busy with other aspects of life. And so now we got this online fan base. It's just a great way to share with everybody else.
Evolved into DVDs, you know, back in the day. But nowadays, I mean, you get a lot of young kids that say the same thing that we do about, you know, like you did about VHS, is, you know, what's a DVD? Because they don't know. If you can't stream it, it's not real. So it kind of evolved away from the DVD thing, because there's very few people buying them and using them anymore.
Right. So this is a big loaded question, but getting back to those origins, because what we want to do in this episode is really talk about Rosies and learn about Roosevelt elk. I just want to start with where you started, about people saying, you know, they don't bugle, you can't rely on vocalizations or calling. What were you guys doing differently at that time than other people were doing? And how did you experience Roosevelt's calling when all these other people were saying, it's not even, they don't do that, that's not their behavior?
Well, I used to spend, you know, our season has changed in Washington. It changed from like October 1st archery season to September 1st. And it wasn't always elk hunting in September. So when I was spending time out there hearing elk bugling and their communication, how they're interact with each other, and I just couldn't believe it when people would tell me, oh, you can't communicate with these animals. They do this on their own. So I just started to try. I started just ignoring what other people say. And at the time, there was like Larry D. Jones was making VHSs. Glenn Berry had a little bit of a video out there. So they had success doing it. And there's no different from their elk to our elk in a sense that, you know, the species is a very social animal. So I just started playing with it and paying attention to what the animals are doing. And in doing so, I adapted a strategy to communicate with the bulls specifically. And, you know, over the years, it's evolved into what it is today, which we've cut a lot of the, you know, BS out of our calling strategies and our, I wouldn't say setups, but in how we go about doing it. So, you know, doing that, and actually first bull I called in was a little spike, ice cow call, and he came walking right to me. And from that minute on, I knew that this was if I did it right, it was repeatable, in a way of actually getting in there and getting the job done. So it just kind of grew from that.
Yeah, where we grew up too, Mark, you had a lot of guys that, you know, the rifle hunting was really big, and there's a bunch of private timberlands around too. And, you know, there's many areas where you can get out in glass clear cuts and try to catch them moving from where they feed in the morning to where they, you know, bed midday. And, And once they get into some of this big timber up here in the Northwest, you know, they're kind of, they disappear. They're kind of like ghosts. And so, you know, even at getting into the early 2000s and stuff, there were still a lot of guys that wouldn't, even in archery hunting, would just hunt them like they did rifle hunting, because that's just all they knew, you know. And then we would, as kids, we would hear about Shannon and some other guys having this great success during archery season and always killing big mature bulls and trying to figure out why. And then when you kind of sit down with them and talk and, you know, figure out that he's understood that Roosevelts aren't just a spot and stock animal, that they can be called in, which a lot of, like you said, a lot of people didn't think was possible early on. Then you can kind of figure out and target how to actually get in and kill those bulls. You know, but it's just, a lot of it has to do with the terrain that they live in and the way that people hunted them back then, because archery hunting really wasn't super popular, especially up here in the Northwest, just because there was other effective ways of killing with a rifle, which is what, as you know, probably most of us, some point or another, that's where our origin started out, was, you know, behind a scope.
So when we think of Rocky Mountain elk and Rocky Mountain zones, you know, you think of the peak of vocal activity being, you know, in September, right? Is that the same case? Like, how does the timing differ for rosies, for coastal rosies, in terms of peak of rut and peak of vocalizations? Or is it line up pretty much with what we think of in terms of Rocky Mountain elk?
Well, I'm not sure what your dates are there, but for us, like early on this first week, there's a lot of you know, bulls trying to establish who's the bigger bull this year, you know, because it changes. A little bit of vocalization on early, but not until about the 15th, 16th on do I have a lot of real aggressive interactions. As the season progresses, even right up to the very last day of September, it gets better and better and better for me. Now, that may be me getting better as the season goes every year, adapting to the conditions and to the animal itself. It's probably more to do with the animals being more more vocal at that time and more into the actual breeding phase of the rut. Right now, I don't expect a lot of interaction, a lot of responses. But when I do get one, I would expect that to equal a bull in my face at this time of the year. So, you know, we basically look for the bulls we want to hunt early on. And then when it's go time, we don't try to force it. So when it's go time, we actually revisit those bulls. And some point during the season, you'll be able to kill any one bull out there.
Yeah, I think one thing too, Mark, about the Roosevelts that differs from the Rocky Mountain bulls that you're talking about, kind of that, you know, peak bugling time of the year, it varies on the coast because you have a lot more small pockets of elk with, you know, very little competition in terms of, you know, having seven or eight bulls around a harem of 100 cows and they're all running around screaming their heads off. We don't get that kind of interaction here. You know, you might find a herd with you know, a half dozen cows and one bull, and the interaction that you might get with them is that he thinks you're just a lone bull, you know, walking a ridgetop looking for cows. You know, but it's pretty rare that we'll call and locate multiple bulls at the same time, especially on the coast range, just because the dynamics of the herds aren't set up like that. There's not multiple bulls out there running around. So, you know, we're really trying to target those individual bulls because they are going to be very, very protective of their harems, the few cows that they do get. But like Shannon said, once we do locate one and using all the knowledge that we have in the woods and get in on one, it's usually an extremely high success rate of at least calling them in and having an opportunity for a shot.
Do you find that they have a pretty small kind of home range, stick to an area?
Yeah, especially when the rut is hot and heavy, these bulls don't want to compete for the cows. So from what I've experienced is these big mature bulls will actually get cows, take them home to where they usually spend their time, which is usually in the deepest, darkest canyon that's around. And I specifically try to find bulls or bulls with harems that don't have a lot of satellites around. So if I focus my attention around clear cuts and the high food areas, then I get a lot of young elk, and then I get a lot more vocalization. I get a lot of competition, which makes it harder for me to actually focus on one animal and get him to come in close enough to get a shot. So what I do is I try to get in areas where it has one bull and a few cows, and he is going to defend his territory. So if I can get that one bull to answer me, and it's just between him and I, and good percentage of the time we'll get an opportunity on.
Yeah, and many of those bulls were, you know, you can target the kind of the classification of bull just by hunting rubs, you know, and spending more time doing that and knowing essentially what size of bull you're dealing with before you ever even really drop into a canyon if you get a response out of one. So we can target those super big old growth canyons that are really, really deep. They don't have a ton of feed in them, even though everything in there is big and green. To support a big herd of elk, it's a little difficult. But once you get a response out of a canyon like that, you can almost guarantee you that it's going to be a really nice, big, mature bull.
So with targeting these bulls that are a bit more isolated and maybe with those cows that they really want to protect, it sounds like you're essentially going for a challenge, right? Like that's what you are going for with your calling. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. I rarely ever cow call. That is the very last trick in my bag. What I do is this bull has his territory. It's established. He's won the fights to earn that territory and those cows. I, as a strange elk in his world, challenge him to the ownership of his territory. So I'm very aggressive at it. I get an answer, and within, you know, 30 minutes, I'm moving in on him and getting closer and building his anticipation for that interaction with me, that encounter, which I think is what actually kills him. It has nothing to do with how good of a caller you are. It's just the process of locating to getting in his face that he will eventually turn and expose himself to you, since that's what elk do, is they come in, visually see each other, and then square up. So I get in close enough, he comes in, and then that's when we usually get our shot. And then in this country, you can't hardly see 30 yards, so he's within distance whenever you do finally see.
So it sounds like, you know, say you locate him, you hear him, or, you know, you do location, you get some sort of response, you know he's maybe down in this canyon. It sounds like you're bugling your way in then, or are you trying to cover as much ground as possible to get as close in as possible, staying silent, and then calling?
Right. So I get an answer, however that may have happened. I'm moving in, and the only time I will bugle at him or try to get him to bugle back is when I need to confirm where he is or how I'm going to approach where he is, or if there's just been too much time between him answering me, I'll try to get another answer. I want to keep him reacting to me. I don't want to bugle so much that he becomes callous and starts ignoring what I'm saying. I actually want to be a legitimate threat, so I'm always pushing at him. And the reason why I'm bugling, moving in on him, is to keep his attention on me, to keep an idea of where he is, and build that that situation, that fight. Trying to pick a fight with him, basically, as I'm moving closer.
Okay, yeah.
And in our ability to even see anything once we drop in, a lot of times it requires that bugling to relocate just to know exactly where we're at. Because, I mean, we'll try to break down the terrain before we go in terms of looking at maps and, you know, whether we're using Onyx or just our GPS to see the topo of the layout. That doesn't always mean that the direct path to that bull is going to be super easy. So, you know, we might have to call an audible on how we get to him based on wind shift or just the way the ground lays out. And many times, you know, if you get into a place where you've got, you know, 10-foot devil's club and rhododendrons that are 20 feet tall, you know, your ability to see anything or, you know, is hindered pretty heavy. So we'll take that time to then relocate that bull if we have to, you know, shift the route that we're taking towards him. You know, usually the direct route is what we would prefer to do, but that doesn't, you know, always work out. Not nearly to our favor, and most of the time, at least with the terrain that we have here, you know, it's different. Rocky Mountain bulls, where, you know, many times you'll locate a bull in a, you know, in a timber patch, and you can literally walk a straight line to them if you have good wind. You know, it's pretty difficult to walk a straight line on the cut up coast range that we have here. So that's where a lot of that bugling will come into place too. And like Shannon said, you know, keeping that bull's attention, because if you don't, and they think that, you know, that all they had to do was bugle at you to win that fight. You know, but building up the anticipation definitely gets those bulls going.
Are you guys often approaching from above then and kind of dropping down into a canyon on a bull?
I'd say more often than not. Yeah. It's just the way our, you know, the road systems, the trails, the, skid roads or whatnot is laid out in this country. Most roads go down ridge tops. So typically we do locate them below us, but it doesn't, I wouldn't treat it any different. You know, a couple of years ago, I killed a bull that was, you know, he was probably 700 feet above me when he answered. So
yeah,
because, we're gonna target him the same way. We're gonna treat him the same.
Yeah. I was just wondering about wind as well. Do you guys get predictable kind of thermal patterns out there in terms of, you know, falling as it's cool in the morning, beginning to switch and make that rise as it heats up? Is that something that you guys encounter, or is it different on that coastal range?
Yeah, our wind isn't as predictable as that. Our elevation changes is, you know, usually right around, you know, 600-700 feet. So you don't get a lot of cooling in the bottom. So there's a little bit, obviously there always will be. Mostly we get some sort of prevailing wind that rolls over the top of ridges and will back up into canyons. And there's a lot of swirling that goes on, and you're crossing your fingers 9 times out of 10, if the wind's going to be right when you get to him. So you play the wind as much as you can. You're not going to win it every time, but you do your best in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the coast too. I mean, you typically should have an onshore flow. You know, you can kind of count on that most of the time. Earlier in the season, it tends to probably be a little less consistent just because it is warmer. But then towards the end of September, as the days shorten and the air temperature cools, you can, you know, it becomes a little bit more typical of what you would expect out here. You don't normally get the thermals where you get, you know, the cold air is settling down in the evenings and then, you know, the warm air rising in during the daytime. That's not a typical situation here. It's just a, like Shannon said, more of a prevailing wind that you get blowing off the ocean.
So with, you know, a tactic that gets talked about a lot, at least in terms of, again, Rockies, is, you know, trying to get on that same elevation plane as a bull. If you locate them, try and get on that same level and then make, you know, an approach kind of side hill to them from that plane. Is that something that you guys consider at all in your tactics as you're dropping down in? Are you kind of, as you talked before about going direct, right? But a lot of times it's not possible. Do you ever factor in like, okay, let's get on his plane, let's get at his elevation and then kind of get over to him? Or is that not something that you guys use as a specific tactic?
It's hardly predictable like that. The elk are lazy. They're going to take the path of least resistance, which is usually an established trail. So I'll use whatever trails are available. I mean, if that trail's going straight down the mountain to him, I'll use it. If it's going straight up the mountain to him, I'll use it. And a lot of times those trails zigzag and they are kind of side healing. So, you know, you really can't pick and choose what direction you come in from. If I tried to go off trail in this country, I'd be swimming in, you know, in every kind of vegetation you can imagine on the coast. So we have to limit that to where the trails are going. So.
Yeah. And more times than not too, we find that, you know, many of these bulls will meet us in the bottom of these canyons down where they feel the most comfortable, where they have the ability to see a little further. You know, so once we drop in, it can be really, really nasty vegetation, but those things they won't live right in that vegetation. By the time we get to the bottom of a canyon, it usually turns into more of a park-like setting. Where they have the ability to roam around and move, and a little more sunlight reaches down there, so there's a little more feed. And it opens up and gives us the ability to actually take some shots that might be more than 10 yards or 15 yards, you know. So sometimes because of the sheer nature of how the canyons on the Coast Range lay out, it might not be very far across. So we'll locate a bull across the canyon and then end up meeting him in the bottom because he came down the other side. You know, so it's just one of those things where depending on how or where we locate that bull, that's going to determine how we end up meeting them. Many times it ends up being down more in those flatter open bottoms. I know that the last several bulls that I've killed have all been on flat, which is nice. And you have to go back out.
That has a lot to do with the time of day we're hunting them. I like to hunt them when they're actually in their beds, and where they bed down is usually a relatively comfortable place. Somewhat flat. You may have to dive down in or climb up to get to that flat spot, but more often than not, where that bull is, where he's going to hold his ground, it's going to be relatively decent. So,
got it. Yeah. So speaking of locating, I'm just curious, especially as relying on calling, and then you're talking about this super thick terrain. I mean, that vocalization can't carry as far, whether it's you trying to locate an elk or the elk responding. You know, it's different than broken territory or more open country where these calls can just travel. How does that play in for you guys? I imagine a lot of that's just covering ground, right?
Cover ground. We bugle 200 times a day. Trying to look. We may bugle one canyon 200 times, you know, because like you said, it's very cut up. And then the thick vegetation just absorbs all your sound.
If you had to like ballpark it, I know this isn't a fair question, but if you had to ballpark it, like in that thicker terrain that's common, what do you think that sound's going to travel? I mean, do you think you need to be within 500 yards of a bull maybe? Or, I mean, what would you ballpark that as?
You know, if it was flat ground, you're saying? Because I can reach a long ways across the canyon to the opposing side, and it will have a significant effect on them. If we're talking flat ground, and thick stuff, you might hear your buddy bugle a couple hundred yards away, but it's not going to shock you when you hear it. And I think with these elk, what you need is you need that reaction. So you need it to somewhat irritate them a little bit. So no, flat ground is it's really tough to get any volume to it, especially if it's been, you know, damp or something, and you get this drip going on or a little bit of wind blowing. Which is why we try to be as loud as we can. If I can be 1 decibel louder than Corey, I'm reaching another 20 yards in a 360 degree circle. I'm covering an exponential more amount of territory. So when I bugle, I at the top of my lungs, doing as loud as I can possibly get, and sacrificing sounding good for being loud. So it's pretty challenging.
There's hope for me. I just got to get loud.
Yeah. It's funny because I was literally practicing calls this morning, and I was kind of thinking that same thing. Is like anytime I push volume to an extreme, or what's an extreme for me, you know, you lose some of that clean, you know, aspect of the call, which is probably fine because that's not in the end realistic anyway. Like not every bull sounds like this perfectly clean, like, you know, 3-note deal. So I was actually thinking through those things this morning as I was calling and kind of wondering how that would play out in terms of gaining volume, but kind of sacrificing that perfection, if you will.
Yeah, just look at it, or how I've always looked at it is in a circle, in a 360 degree circle. If I'm, you know, 10 yards farther, I'm covering so much more ground throughout the day. I think that alone is going to benefit you in locating bulls that you may not have located sounding really pretty.
Yeah. And we've had times too, where, you know, we'll call and not get a response from one side of the canyon, and we'll, you know, drive around to the other side and call back to the direction that we were just, you know, calling from, and end up locating a bull that wasn't maybe 200 yards below the ridgeline that we were standing on. You know, and many times it's just how that sound carries. If we would have called from the opposite side to begin with, he might have fired back right away. But, you know, that 200 yards, the vegetation in between us and them, and then calling out over the top of him, he may have heard it, but it wasn't to the point where it created any reaction coming out of him. So, you know, getting around onto a different angle and screaming right in his face, then that changes the dynamics of everything in terms of, you know, maybe the proximity of where we're at to him and where he feels that the threat is coming from and those types of things. So, it definitely can change, you know, how that sound travels with the vegetation that we have here on the coast. You know, I check my calls. I actually started doing this a couple of years ago, not so much as terms of like how they sound, but in terms of how loud they are. And I'll run a decibel meter phone app and check them, see which bugle's louder, see which reed is louder. And run them like that is kind of how I test to get ready for the season for myself. And I usually find I can get somewhere between like 85 and 90 decibels out of a call, which is pretty loud. Cause like Shannon's saying, that's more important to us than trying to win the next Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation calling championships. You know, our competition's out in the woods. It's fun to sound super realistic, but like you said, Mark, it's not realistic to sound then, you know, not all bulls sound realistic. Many of them sound.
Right? Yeah.
So.
Also, I do two bugles to try to locate, and I've watched elk when I try to locate them, you know, across the canyon or whatnot. And typically, you know, those elk are just, chewing their cud, or they're walking around, or they're feeding or something. So my first bugle, if you watch on video, is just a real loud scream, fairly short. All that does is that gets that bull to turn his head, his ears, and look in my direction, and then I'll follow that up with a pretty clean bugle with that chuckle at the end. And nine times out of 10, I get that response off that second bugle, but because I set it up with that first scream.
Mm. So the first one's just kind of grabbing his attention. The second one's really getting under his skin, if you will.
Exactly. So if it's a super dense area and I need him to be looking my way and listening for me, that first one gets that accomplished. The second one gets him to react to me.
Yeah, that's funny. You can picture that. Like, he's sitting there chewing his cud, you said, and it's almost like, did I just hear something? You know, on that first one, and then you come in with that second one, and then he's fired up.
Exactly. Yeah. And, man, watching it, you know, really confirmed what I suspected going on out there. You know, they're sniffing the cows. They're doing whatever they're doing. And when they look up at you and then you follow them up, and I think it's that chuckle. That chuckle just ticks off those bulls. And then his, you know, he'll throw that head back. You'll see his mouth open. And then, you know, a few seconds later, you might hear that bugle finally hit your ears. It's pretty neat. And it's worked over the years. It's increased my attempt to locate a bull and my reaction by quite a bit by just adding that second bugle.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Almost disbelief. You know, I mean, that's maybe not something that they're used to having bulls, you know, up on ridgetop screaming back at them. And they lift their head, get their attention, you know, kind of in this, like, really, there's another bull that's going to try to come into my canyon and take my cows. And then as soon as you hit them with that second bugle, then they fire right back. You know, but there's been times too where you watch them put their head back down and go back to feeding if you don't follow it up. You know, and sometimes we'll be able to see a smaller bull or something that we'll do that with, and he's not the bull that we're targeting. So you can call at him and kind of learn a little bit from their reactions.
But it's very rare we ever see elk that we're bugling at. That was just a unique situation over the years that I've paid attention to. Majority of the time, and how I prefer it is I can't see where I'm hunting them, so they can't see me.
Yeah. So you just said how you prefer it. I was curious just to lay an open-ended question out there. In your mind, what is the ideal hunting scenario? Like, so walk us through, like, okay, we're going to cover this type of ground, this method. We're going to, you know, maybe call and locate. We're going to move in. Like, begin to lay out, if all goes perfect, from locating all the way through a shot opportunity, what would you say is ideal, or what has been the most successful scenario for you over the years in terms of commonalities?
I roll out of bed about 8 o'clock in the morning. I get up to a ridge top or something, just looking down into a bowl of a canyon, probably a couple hundred yards below me. You see that it's got this nice flat spot down in there. It's got a big open bottom. I hammer that with the bugle, and I get that echo, this ring in the canyon. And I get that roar right back to me within a few seconds. The wind's perfect. I drop down in there. It's thick and it's brushy getting in there. I come to about 100 yards from where I expect the bull to be. It opens up into a great big park-like setting, you know, big trees and nice, cool, shady area. Give him one more bugle, and I hear the brush breaking him coming my way. And that is my perfect scenario, and which is how the majority of them play out over the years.
Got me fired up. That sounds good to me.
Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah. It's funny too, because, you know, I mean, we don't get out of bed really early. It's just not something that we've found to be highly successful in locating elk early in the morning. And then, you know, people wonder why they walk away from them, and it's not, the elk's not walking away. It has a place to go, you know? So if you let them get to where they're going, then hunting them in the middle part of the day. And you've started hearing a lot more people kind of bring that up. You know, I mean, you've heard Corey Jacobson talk about it. You've heard the Born and Raised guys, you know, as they kind of go back and analyze some of their successes over the years, the majority of those elk end up getting killed in the middle part of the day when they are stationary. You know, so for us, an ideal situation is, you know, probably locating that bull around 10 o'clock. And we really don't too often, unless we've covered a lot of ground in the area that we're camping at, we need to get outside of that area that requires travel. We won't leave camp, you know, much before 8. You know, many times we're to where we basically left off the day before by nine. You know, we have a bull in mind that's because we've found his rubs. We know the size of the bull that's in there, and we're going to target a certain canyon, and we feel comfortable about that being the mature bull in that area. So then that's when we'll try to locate, you know, mid morning. Once we're on them, I mean, if it's going to go down, it's usually by about noon, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that thing's typically laying on the ground, you know? So in a perfect world, that's, you know, even from a timing standpoint, that gives you 2 o'clock, usually out of the canyon by about five, quartered out, got your buddies there to help pack out, and you're back at camp celebrating by, you know, 7 o'clock, getting ready to go back and do it the next day. So, you know, for me, perfect is that, you know, it's, you can actually put a timeline to it as well. You know, from start to finish.
Yeah. Watching you on the death hike makes more sense now, Corey, because you were always like waking up in the morning with like no hurry whatsoever to get going. So now I see why.
Yeah, I was the last guy to roll out of camp.
Yeah. You're like, what do you guys do? Why are you leaving so early? We got a long day.
Yeah.
I love it.
Exactly.
No, that's a lesson. I mean, even on Rockies, that's a lesson I've learned the hard way. I mean, it was like literally hitting my head against the wall on so many encounters of early morning of just bulls are bugling, catching up to them. I felt like I was playing cat and mouse, but in the end I realized, man, they're on a mission just to get to where they're going. And it's going to take me being super lucky or just hitting that right nerve to get them off of that mission of getting where they're going. Man, I can't tell you how many times I guess at this point wasted trying to play a bull when it, in all reality, is now I'm more of the mindset of stick with them, be patient, but don't make the play, you know, not at that early morning hour, but almost just kind of hang with them, hang behind them, see where they're going, let them settle down, and then make the play. That's certainly something that I've learned the hard way by experience.
Yeah, I've done the same thing. You know, I spent a lot of time hunting Cascade Roosevelts, and, you know, they're essentially a Rocky Mountain elk up where I hunt them by the Pacific Crest Trail. And I used to do that when I was back before I started hunting with Shannon, especially when, you know, after you sit down and talk to somebody that really has, you know, a next level knowledge in elk, it all kind of starts to come together. And I'm sure you guys get that, you know, obviously hosting the podcast and talking to everybody that you do. But, you know, I used to get up early, super early in the morning and start chasing bugles. And I just wondered why I could never call these bulls back in. I just thought it was because I wasn't a very good caller. You know, I had marginal success, but it was mostly because I would wander around the middle part of the day, you know, hunting them like I used to with a rifle. And once you start putting everything together, you say, well, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you following them in their bedding area? Why don't you wait till they get there and then go kill them? And having those conversations with Shannon early on was, he's like, you're just wasting your time in the morning because they have a place to go. You know, they might bugle at you, but it's pretty rare that they're going to turn around and come running back in at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, with these Roosevelts, we just kind of eliminate that completely out. And like we said, he's got a system down that really eliminates all the BS. It's more straight and to the point. We might not have, you know, 50 call-ins in a season, but if we have five, there's about a 90% chance right now that you're going to have five elk laying on the ground. So, you know, I went from having about a 46% success rate in the Cascades to about an 85% success rate on the Coast Range, just simply because you start working with a system and eliminating all the fluff. So,
yeah, you know, a lot of people misinterpret, you know, when they get an answer from a bull and he, you know, quote, pushes cows away, but he's never pushing cows. As a matter of fact, the cows were heading to the bedding, and well, your interpretation of him pushing is nothing more than them going somewhere. So, and then you follow them, the more time that you're close enough for them to catch a wind, you know, see you or wind you, the higher likelihood that they're going to bust and, you know, blow out of there. You won't be able to call them in. So by learning all that the hard way, I took it out. So if I find bulls in feeding areas, I will study the area and figure out where they will most likely bed, and then I'll target those in the, you know, late morning or early afternoon.
Do you guys do anything specific with like caller shooter setups? You know, you think of like, you know, again, hearing a guy like Corey Jacobson talk about the arc and how that works well for him. Does anything specific come to mind in terms of being in that thicker terrain or using those game trails and approaches to your advantage in terms of when you're hunting with a caller shooter setup?
Right. So early on, I used to, I really thought setting up on the elk was the way to go. But over the years and paying attention to the ones that we didn't kill when they got in close, the setup is the reason why we didn't get that shot. So today, I like the caller, the shooter to be in the same place or not very far away.
Or the same person.
Yeah, you know, or the same person in a lot of the cases. And you need to be very dynamic. You know, these animals are coming in at whatever direction they feel like they can. You need to be able to adjust immediately. And a lot of times we can't see 20 yards. So when you realize where he is and what direction he's coming around this pile of, you know, this stump or that stump or this ridge, you need to be able to react to that and move 10, 15, 20 yards. And you got to remember, he thinks you're an elk, so moving is not going to hurt the situation. It's just going to add to it. So, yeah, we're very dynamic. We don't really do setups anymore. And you're working on a video that shows that very well and how we had to adjust to a bull coming in multiple times to actually even get to see him, let alone get a shot at him.
Yeah, and, running camera and trying to capture all this, you know – like if I'm filming Shannon, he's caller shooter and I'm just essentially right over his shoulder for the most part. You know, we can't have much of a separation between where we're at just because of the terrain and the vegetation doesn't really allow for it too often. So, you know, we want to be able to move dynamically and extremely fluid through those areas to not necessarily be, anything other than what an elk would be like moving through. You know, we don't worry about noise because elk are noisy. If you spend any time in the elk woods, you'll understand that they are noisy characters by nature. And so, you know, we don't worry about that. We worry more just about obviously being in the right spot when that bull is coming in. And so we have to be able to adapt and move.
And being noisy, it's part of my calling strategy as well. You know, he needs to know exactly where I'm at. When he doesn't know, he gets a little concerned, gets a little worried, gets a little nervous. So as long as he knows where I'm approaching him from, he can approach me from that same direction or the opposite direction. And I think that kills a lot of the elk. It's just the little sounds, the twigs breaking, the little groans, the little grunts.
Yeah, we had a perfect scenario with that last year, the bull that Shannon killed on film. It's on our YouTube channel. The bull came in and he got to a point where he knew roughly where we were at. We were on a fairly narrow kind of spine ridge in some younger reprod. We called him out of the taller timber out into more of an open scenario. And he came in and you can see on film, he gets to a certain point and he stops and he's looking around and you can actually watch his antler tips moving. And he got to the point where he's looking back towards his cows and he didn't know where that bull was at, where we were. And so he chuckles, you know, it's kind of like I need to pinpoint back where you're at again. And as soon as he did that, Shannon hit him with just a real short, quick kind of a moan. And that bull snapped his head around right to our direction and came walking right through the brush. Unfortunately for him, it was to his demise because he gave him about a 19 yard frontal and he hit him right perfect where he was supposed to. And that bull didn't go 30 yards before he died. But, you know, it was just watching that interaction and it's all on film and it's perfect film to be able to see, you know, that bull comes in, he's vocal, he gets to a certain point, he stops, he looks around because he's supposed to be hearing this bull. And at that point, you know, we're quiet because we're standing there waiting for that, anticipating the bull to walk in so Shannon could take the shot. And when he didn't hear anything, he wanted to relocate where that bull is at because they get nervous, you know, I mean, they don't want to get blindsided by another bull or something. So, it just was perfect the way that Shannon responded to his chuckles when he was trying to locate where we were and that bull. I mean, that was all it took.
On shot encounters, like what has made the difference for you guys over the years in terms of the little things on being able to not only get in bow range, but actually make that a punch tag and not just a blown opportunity?
Yeah. So calling elk in when you're in a, if you want to call it a setup like us, where the caller, the shooter is pretty much at the same point, more often than not, they're walking towards you. So I've had to adapt to that scenario and figure out how to kill elk when they're coming my direction. And I started taking those frontal, they're not really frontals, they're quartering twos, just in front of that near shoulder. It's the opposite angle as a quartering away, you know, just coming in from the other direction. Very high percentage kill, usually under 20 yards or not much more than 20 yards. I mean, we had to adapt to the elk coming at, you know, our direction. So those quarter and two shots have been money for us. And, you know, and then, you know, we shoot in a lot of thick cover. So you can't see all of the obstacles in your way. You hope that it's soft vegetation you hit. But in preparation for that, you know, we've went to a real heavy setup, which is what these 300 grain broadheads and the 600 plus grain arrow setups is done for us. You know, like a train going down tracks. It may not be going fast, but you gotta, you know, getting it to change direction is very tough. So that's the direction I've gone personally with my setup is heavier versus fast, and just trying to cover up a little bit of that error when you don't see that obstacle in your way.
Yeah. What is can you dive deeper into your setup specifically, like what shaft you use in, broadhead, you know, how it's been for you since you made the change type stuff?
Yeah, so in 2015 I lost a bull with your standard 125 grain broadhead, just your typical axis arrow, probably in the 460-470 total grain. I hit a twig about 3 yards in front of me. The elk was at 17. It deflected the arrow far enough to where it was not a fatal shot. So it really irritated me, got to me. So we started looking at a heavier arrow setup. We found Valkyrie. He's got, you know, 200 to 300 grain broadheads. And then in our discussions with him, he likes the high FOC for downrange accuracy. So we shoot the X Impact.
Yeah, we're shooting the Black Eagle X Impact micro diameter, and the 250s. And Brent, the guy at Valkyrie, has spent a lot of time and a lot of money R&D and all this stuff. So we pretty much have just, you know, after we met with him, started discussing what we were going to shoot, just kind of took his advice in terms of, you know, what his best arrow setup was. And so we run a Valkyrie center pin. Jagger broadheads on the front end, and I shoot a 250. Shannon shoots a 300. Total arrow weight is either right at or just above 600 grains. We're running four fletch. We've been playing around with a few other two fletch setups, but mostly four fletch, just, you know, to help steer the back end of that arrow. It runs the center pin system is pretty unique because it actually runs on a sleeve on the front end of the arrow shaft itself. So it protects the first inch of the arrow. And then the center pin inside actually goes in another quarter of an inch past the sleeve itself. So it really, really strengthens the front end of that arrow shaft, with the heavy FOC. And it's just, what we found is the downrange accuracy is extremely good. That super heavy, FOC arrow will penetrate and pull through rather than trying to be pushed from behind, in terms of the physics of how that head travels. And we get phenomenal penetration. Shannon's quarter two shot last year hit the bull right in front of the front shoulder. And if it wasn't for the rear hip, it would have been a pass through from a frontal shot. And but that we found that broadhead embedded inside the back hip of that bull, which was extremely impressive, especially the size of the diameter hole that cut through it. And we've posted some pictures of that on our social, on Instagram, Facebook as well. So if anybody wants to go see that, they can. But it's a pretty pretty severely devastating setup. It's nice to know that, you know, if you do have something light in your way, that you're not going to have nearly the deflection that you would with a smaller setup. And we've got, you know, a few other scenarios on film where you watch little twigs or small branches completely change the direction that arrow flies. That's the main reason why we wanted to go to something different. It's not that those other setups that we used to shoot don't kill elk, because they absolutely do. But, you know, we're planning for worst case scenarios in this situation. You know, the bull that Shannon lost, the bull first stopped and he was at full draw on him, he didn't have a shot, and the bull moved and Shannon stopped him in an opening that he hadn't looked through. So that small twig that was hanging, you know, 3 yards out in front of his arrow, you know, that's not what he was focused on. You can't see everything, especially in this country. And so, you know, once you lose something like that and you see how much deflection you get, you start questioning what you're shooting, and then, you know, maybe try to work into something different. And that's where we ended up with Valkyrie.
Yeah. And, you know, if I can change my deflection by inches, at 20 yards, that might equal a recovery. So I think it's that old adage where you you plan for the worst and hope for the best shot scenario. Hopefully it pays off in the years, and I can imagine it will. There's just a lot of obstacles here that you're never going to be able to see them all. So,
yeah. I mean, what's your typical shot distance in this country? It's got to be incredibly low.
It's inside of 20 yards for the most part. You might be able to see 30 or 40, but, you know, through a hole or something. But shot wise, usually we kill our elk. It probably average distance is about 20 yeah. yards.
I haven't killed one on the coast yet that's been over 30. Of the five bulls that I've killed on the Oregon coast, they've all been under 30 yards. And you will get, I mean, there are guys, and don't get us wrong, there are guys that will kill them in clear cuts and have to shoot 80 yards. They just are hunting different than what we do. We found what works really, really well for us. You know, it might not be the only way, but it's the right way. I mean, you know, it's just a, you know, maybe a slightly different style than what many other people have adapted to, but it's also part of the analytics of going back and really evaluating successes. And that's one of the things that I think was very intriguing with me early on talking with Shannon was that, you know, most guys don't really go back and really, really analyze their failures. And when you do that, you really start to figure out what went wrong, and analyzing your successes and what went right doesn't really ever tell much of the story. It's what you did that was wrong. And so, you know, like we said, trying to cut out the BS with these coastal Roosevelts, you can't make very many mistakes, because, you know, if they come in and something happens and you blow that setup, you're probably not going to get that bull back anytime soon. And they don't have to go very far before they feel comfortable and are completely out of sight, out of sound, out of range. And so, you know, the ability to try to get a bull to come back in, you know, it's very unlikely that that's going to happen the second or third time. So we want to make sure that first encounter is the one and only that we have.
Got it. Yeah, it's good stuff. What have you guys learned, or is there anything you feel people maybe newer to Roosevelts should know about after the shot? Like in the country you've talked about, the scenarios you've talked about, do they tend to go uphill, downhill? Are they running for cover? Is there any sort of patterns that you've seen there over the years?
They usually go back the direction they came, for whatever. Probably most animals do that. You know, if you don't find them within 100 yards, I'd start worrying, and just sit and wait and evaluate what happened as much as you can. Usually our elk, it's a fatal shot. They don't go 100 yards before they're down. If they go farther than that, then we need to really understand why it wasn't fatal and go from there. And a lot of times from that point, if we get 100 yards and the elk hasn't crashed, now I need to get another shot on him. So it's no longer just tracking him. It's getting another shot on that bull on the hoof. So we change how we approach it once he gets past roughly 100 yards. And has a lot to do with the territory too. If he's running, you know, if he bolted downhill, he may go farther, but, you know, they're a big animal, man, and, they're hard to kill. They really are. So you need to really pay attention to your shot placement. And as soon as you shoot, you try to collect as much data when he's running off as you can. And that's listening. You know, people, woohoo, yeah, no. Right then is when I want to understand exactly what that animal's doing until I hear him kicking the dirt. There's no celebrating going on until we're actually looking at him on the ground. So,
man, can't believe we've been at it for about an hour already. What haven't we covered that you would like to tell us and listeners about to help us be more effective in hunting Roosevelts?
I think in general, it's not necessarily just Roosevelts, but I think if you break hunting down into different aspects, that you can focus on those aspects independently. And that's how I've approached elk hunting, is where do elk live and where can I find them? Once I find them, how can I get this animal to react to me, which is usually vocally or, you know, any kind of reaction when I'm trying to get him to tell me where he's at. Collect that data, analyze it by itself. Next step is, well, what do I have to do to get him to come to me to present a shot? Once you figure all that out, you move on to what do I have to do to put this animal on the ground so I have meat in my freezer? And I think to simplify all that, you break it down in those smaller little pieces, and you just focus on them independently, and you'll actually improve your success rate.
Which of those pieces do you think is the biggest difference maker for most guys? Like, where do people get hung up the most, do you think?
Well, I think finding elk is tough for people, which is tough for everybody. But I think that call-in aspect of it, that third stage, that if you understand elk, it becomes really easy. If you don't understand them and you're 400 yards away and you're sitting there having a conversation with the animal, you're probably never going to kill him. So they're all, you know, critical in that very last one, that success part. But I think they overlook a little bit of the calling one a little bit more. And then finding elk, a lot of people want to see them. And in seeing them, you're putting yourself in a place where you're probably not going to call an elk in anyway. You know, elk that feed in clear cuts are relatively nervous, especially a mature bull. You know, he's witnessed carnage in that clear cut before, I almost guarantee it. So he's learned to not go out there in the daylight. He's learned that that's a place that's very risky. And the only reason he's there is because his girls want to go to the dance party. So locating elk in places where you can kill them is very critical in that step as well.
I think people get too concerned about making mistakes. You know, in the scenario of making noise, in a scenario of what do you do if there's cows in the way, if there's a satellite in there, they get far too concerned about making a mistake and blowing that elk out. And, you know, many times, like Shannon was saying, if you understand elk, you act like an elk, you think like an elk, those scenarios can actually kind of work to your advantage. And, you know, we had a situation like that last year where, the herd bull had, probably one of the largest harems of cows that we've ever seen on the coast. I mean, it was, you know, in excess of 25 cows. There was a couple of spike satellite bulls that were running around with him. And we got into a scenario where the spike was in between us and that bull. And it's not a situation that I had dealt with much in the past and was, you know, obviously concerned about, you know, well, what happens if you bump that spike? And the reality of it is, and Shannon kind of talks about it, or we talked about it last year, was, you know, you got to blow that spike out of there, and spooking that spike is okay as long as when he busts, you become that other elk that pushed him out. So, you know, a scenario where that spike takes off, bugle right away, you know, because that big bull isn't going to necessarily think, oh, there's a human down here pushing that spike out of there. That's just another bull and he's running from it. You know, similar scenario with cows. If they bust, you can do the same thing. But, you know, understanding those types of situations and not being concerned about, you know, making a mistake and blowing that spike out of there, which is what a lot of people will do, will obviously help you with your success. Because if that spike goes running out, you bugle, that big bull that is with those cows now thinks there's another bull in there that's truly trying to take, you know, his harem over. And so that's when we were actually able to call that bull in. I had him at about 4 yards at full draw. And unfortunately, because of like what we talked about with Roosevelt's vegetation, I didn't have shot. You know, we got I had pretty much a broadside shot with very, very large huckleberry vines sticking off of an old cedar stump that just completely covered his vitals. But, you know, so it didn't end the way that we were hoping, but it sure was a learning experience to be able to get an experience that, you know, those types of situations. And we don't get very many learning situations. We get what, a month total, most in some states it's less than that. Washington's 2 weeks to try to get out and learn as much as you can while you're out there. So that's why people don't want to make mistakes, because it might be their one and only opportunity. So you have to take every advantage you can to learn from it, and not be super concerned about making those mistakes and making noise and things like that, and learn to think more like an elk, than what most people probably try to do.
Yeah, man, so much good stuff in there.
Yeah. Great advice.
Yeah. Steve, you probably experienced a little bit of that last year in Colorado versus how you would typically hunt in Idaho. You know, I mean, you're typically much more of a spot and stock guy in the open country in Idaho, and then you get to Colorado, and here it's all about bugles and it's all about calling them in close, because you guys were hunting in much thicker vegetation than what you're probably used to. And it does change absolutely everything, you know, from what types of shots you're going to get to the way that those elk react, you know, the way that your encounter is going to lay out. So, you know, even scenarios like that would probably be great learning experiences for you. And I know we've talked offline about this, but you know, you're working on learning how to bugle a lot more over this last year than you ever did yep. before, starting to understand the effectiveness of what that can mean to your success rate. And some of that might have to do with where you're hunting at. You know, in Idaho, you might not need to do it in the area that you're at, but you know, there are some portions of Idaho where it absolutely will make or break your ability to kill an elk and being able to bugle and understand.
Yeah. That. Yeah. Definitely learned that. Like, I think we're all products of the elk hunting that we grew up in, and mine the last decade has been open country and backpacking. And so we just learned to, it's just an entirely different way to hunt elk. So yeah, it was a lot of fun and opened my eyes to, you know, essentially how you guys hunt and born and raised. You guys are very similar from the sounds of it. And it's something trying to, you know, round out my hunting quiver as far as skills that I have, and definitely trying to learn how to bugle better.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that if you can kill a Roosevelt on the coast out here, just because of the difficulties that the terrain and everything give you, if you can kill one of these things, you can kill an elk anywhere. Cause I've heard it said in seminars and stuff that Shannon's given, an elk is an elk no matter where they're at. It's the only thing that really changes is where they're living. In terms of how they act. So being able to adapt to those that environmental change is really the only thing you have to be able to do. You know, so coming out here, if you guys, I mean, we'll see it this year. You're going to have, you know, the Elk 101 guys are coming out to hunt with Dave Brinker and on the Oregon coast. And we'll see what it's like with those guys, you know, adapting from hunting mostly Rocky Mountains to now something completely different in terms of how those styles, you know, work back and forth. And I think, you know, Corey and crew hunt a bit more like we do, but just, you know, in the Rocky Mountain region of the country, as opposed to out here on the coast. So it could work in their favor, being different than many other guys that are, you know, big open country, sit on ridge tops, glass bowls up, and then try to slip in and kill them without even having to call. That doesn't work here, you know, so we've had to change up what we do and learn and evolve, and what we do does work here. And even the way that we do it too, we don't target any small bulls. You know, we're not opportunists. We're not looking to kill the first legal anything that walks out in front of us. We're looking for the bigger mature bulls, because the interaction is just that much better. And killing a bull on public land, which is all we hunt, has a bit more sweet taste of success when you kill a bull that's lived, you know, in and amongst anybody and everybody that wants to hunt him for the last, you know, somewhere between 6 and 10 years of his life. It just is a much, much more rewarding feeling when you kill a bull on public land that's big, you know, big, big mature bull.
Cool, guys. You're literally hours away at this point from kicking off opening weekend. Before we let you go and get to that, what are some good resources that you'd point us to, maybe to, you know, see some of those films you talked about, learn more about what you guys are up to, and just kind of get connected with you guys?
Yeah, we got, obviously, today, I don't think anybody exists that doesn't have some kind of social media thing. If you're not online, then I don't think you're really alive. So we do have Instagram and Facebook. You can follow us at Angry Spike Productions on Instagram. We can link to our Facebook from there, which is just anybody can search Angry Spike or Angry Spike Productions on there. We do have a website that'll link everything together too. It's angryspike.com. We do have all of our older DVDs are listed on our website. They can actually get to our VHX channel from there. I'll make a code for anybody that listens to this. It'll just be under XO, EXO. If they put that in, there'll be a significantly steep discount if people want to watch some Roosevelt hunting between now and the start of the season. Pay a couple bucks and you'll get to watch our collective series, which is all the DVDs that were ever put out in the past. We have a YouTube channel. Most of the links to that are either on the website or through our social stuff as well, which has been the last 4 or 5 years where the hunting has all been put onto our YouTube channel. We're going to continue to put what we find as quality films onto those. We don't make hunting films, though. Just keep that in mind. We make films of hunts, so most of our stuff isn't going to tell a story. It's going to be real and raw. It's just straight to the point. We don't try to, you know, create any kind of feel-good story out of our hunts. It's, you know, typically very little music, if any at all, and straight to the point. So you can get to our YouTube channel, watch most of our recent stuff on there as well. We've had, you know, some really, really good responses from our YouTube videos. People kind of like the natural aspect of it, that it is, they makes them feel like they were actually out on the hunt. So that's all of our social stuff. And at any given time, when people can reach out and ask questions, you know, we're really good about responding either on Facebook or Instagram to messages that people might have, things that they want to learn more in depth. We try to get back to people as quickly as possible. So try to be a resource too, and not just keep everything in.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in. We are getting smack dab into the middle of elk season as this is released. So hopefully you can not only learn from this episode, but actually take this knowledge soon and put it into practice in the field. As always, guys, appreciate the feedback. Appreciate you guys tuning in. If there's anything we can help with or any questions you have, anything like that, just shoot us an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com.